brought tidings to the elves of the fate of Gondolin, the doves and pigeons of Turgon, and they, arm and march away, in brackets. The coming of the message was followed by the Council's, C-O-U-N-C-I-L-S, C-O-U-N-S-E-L-S, notebook C, of the gods and the uproar of the elves. But in C, nothing is said of the sorrow and wrath of the gods, or the veil dropped between Valmar and Kor, referred to in B, where the meaning can surely only be that the march of the elves from Valinor was undertaken in direct opposition to the will of the Valar, that the Valar were bitterly opposed to the intervention of the elves of Valinor in the affairs of the great lands. There may well be a connection here with Vaire's words, 1:19, when the fairies left Kor, that lane, that is, Orlore Malle, that led past the cottage of lost play, was blocked forever with great impassable rocks. Elsewhere, there is only one other reference to the effect of the message from across the sea, and that is in the words of Lindo to Eriol in The Cottage of Lost Play, 1:16. Inwe, whom the gnomes call Inwithiel, was king of all the Eldar when they dwelt in Kor. That was in the days before hearing the lament of the world, that is, the great lands, Inwe led them forth to the lands of men. Later, Meriel y Turinki told Eriol, 1:129, that Inwe, her grandsire's sire, perished in that march into the world. But Ingil, his son, went long ago back to Valinor and is with Manwe. And there is a reference to Inwe's death in B. In C, the Solosimpi only agreed to accompany the expedition on condition that they remain by the sea, and the reluctance of the third kindred, on account of the kinslaying at Swanhaven, survived, the Silmarillion, page 251. But there is no suggestion that the elves of Valinor were transported by ship, indeed the reverse, for the Solosimpi fare along all the beaches of the world, and the expedition is a march, though there is no indication of how they came to the great lands. Both outlines refer to Eärendil being driven eastwards on his homeward voyage from Kor, and to his finding the dwellings at Sirion's mouth ravaged when he finally returned there. But B does not say who carried out the sack and captured Elwing. In C, it was a raid by orcs of Melkor. Compare the entry in the name list to the fall of Gondolin, page 215. Egolmoth got even out of the burning of Gondolin and dwelt after at the mouth of Sirion, but was slain in a dire battle there when Melkor seized Elwing. Neither outline refers to Elwing's escape from captivity. Both mention Eärendil's going back to the ruins of Gondolin. In C, he returns there with Voronwë and finds men and gnomes. Another entry in the name list to the fall of Gondolin, page 215, bears on this. Goldor won out of Gondolin and even the onslaught of Melkor upon the dwellers at Sirion's mouth, and went back to the ruins with Eärendil. Both outlines mention the departure of the elves from the great lands after the binding of Melkor to Tol Eressëa. C, adding a reference to wars with men and to the Eldar being unable to endure the strife of the world. And both refer to Eärendil's going there subsequently, but the order of events seems to be different. In B, Eärendil, on his way back from Kor, sights Tol Eressëa and the fleet of the elves, presumably the fleet returning from the great lands, whereas in C, the departure of the elves is not mentioned until after Eärendil's return to Sirion. But the nature of these outlines is not conveyed in print. They were written at great speed, catching fugitive thoughts, and cannot be pressed hard. However, with the fate of Elwing, B and C seem clearly to part company. In B, there is a simple reference to her death, apparently associated with the curse of the Nauglofring, and from the order in which the events are set down, it may be surmised that her death took place on the journey to Tol Eressëa. C specifically refers to the sinking of Elwing and the Nauglofring, but says that Elwing became a seabird, an idea that survived the Silmarillion, page 247. This perhaps gives more point to Eärendil's going to the Isle of Seabirds, mentioned in both B and C. In the latter, he hopes that Elwing will return among the seabirds. Seventh part. In B, the concluding part of the tale is merely summarized in the words, his voyage to the firmament, with a reference to the other outline C, and in the latter we get some glimpses of a narrative. It seems to be suggested that the brightness of Eärendil, quite unconnected with the Silmaril, arose from the diamond dust of Kor, but also in some sense from the exaltation of his grief. An isolated jotting elsewhere in C asks, what became of the Silmarils after the capture of Melko? My father at this time gave no answer to the question, but the question is itself a testimony to the relatively minor importance of the jewels of Feanor, if also perhaps a sign of his awareness that they would not always remain so, that in them lay a central meaning of the mythology yet to be discovered. It seems, too, that Eärendil sailed into the sky in continuing search for Elwing. He sets sail on the oceans of the firmament in order to gaze over the earth, and that his passing through the door of night, the entrance made by the gods in the Wall of Things in the West, C1, 215-16, did not come about through any devising, but because he was hunted by the moon. With this last idea, compare 1.193, where Ilinsor, steersman of the moon, is said to hunt the stars. The later of the two schemes for the Lost Tales, which gives a quite substantial outline for Gilfanan's tale, where I have called it D, C1.234, here fails us, for the concluding passage is very condensed, in part erased, and ends abruptly early in the tale of Eärendil. I give it here, beginning at a slightly earlier point in the narrative. Of the death of Tinwellant and the flight of Gwenaflin, see page 51. How Beren avenged Tinwellant and how the necklace became his. How it brought sickness to Denuvial, see page 246. And how Beren and Denuvial faded from the earth. How their sons, sick, dwelt after them, and how the sons of Feanor came up against them with a host because of the Silmaril. How all were slain but Elwing, daughter of Dymord, see page 139, son of Beren, fled with the necklace. Of Tuor's vessel with white sails. How folk of the Lothlim dwelt at Sirion's mouth. Eärendil grew fairest of all men that were or are. How the mermaids, Oarni, loved him. How Elwing came to the Lothlim, and of the love of Elwing and Eärendil. How Tuor fell into age, and how Ulmo beckoned to him at eve, and he set forth on the waters and was lost. How Idril swam after him. In the following passage, my father seems at first to have written, Eärendil, lacuna, Oarni builded Wingelot, and set forth in search of, lacuna, leaving Voronwë with Elwing. Where the first lacuna perhaps said, with the aid of, though nothing is now visible. But then he wrote, Eärendil built Swanwing, and then partly erased the passage. It is impossible to see now what his intention was. Elwing's lament, how Ulmo forbade his quest, but Eärendil would yet sail to find the passage to Mandos. How Wingelot was wrecked at Falasquil, and how Eärendil found the carven house of Tuor there. Here, Scheme D ends. There is also a reference at an earlier point in it to the messengers sent from Gondolin. The doves of Gondolin fly to Valinor at the fall of that town. This outline seems to show a move to reduce the complexity of the narrative, with Wingelot being the ship in which Eärendil attempted to sail to Mandos, and in which he was wrecked at Falasquil. But the outline is too brief and stops too soon to allow any certain conclusions to be drawn. A fourth outline, which I will call E, is found on a detached sheet. In this, Tuor is called Tur, see page 148. Fall of Gondolin, the feast of Glorfindel, the dwelling by the waters of Sirion's mouth, the mermaids come to Eärendil. Tur groweth sea-hungry, his song to Eärendil. One evening he calls Eärendil, and they go to the shore. There is a skiff. Tur bids farewell to Eärendil and bids him thrust it off. The skiff fares away into the west. Eärendil hears a great song swelling from the sea as Tuor's skiff dips over the world's rim. His passion of tears upon the shore, the lament of Idril. The building of Eärum. Note 9. Eärum is emended, at the first occurrence only, from Eärum. And following it stood the name Eärnhamma, but this was struck out. Eärnhamma is Old English, eagle coat, eagle dress. End of note. The coming of Elwing, Eärendil's reluctance, the whetting of Idril, the voyage and foundering of Eärum in the north, and the vanishing of Idril. How the sea maids rescued Eärendil and brought him to Tuur's Bay, his coastwise journey. The rape of Elwing. Eärendil discovers the ravaging of Sirion's mouth. The building of Wingolot. He searches for Elwing and is blown far to the south. Wirilome. He escapes eastward. He goes back westward. He descries the Bay of Faerie. The Tower of Pearl, the Magic Isles, the Great Shadows. He finds Kor empty. He sails back, crusted with dust and his face afire. He learns of Elwing's foundering. He sitteth on the Isle of Seabirds. Elwing, as a sea mew, comes to him. He sets sail over the margin of the world. Apart from the fuller account of Tuor's departure from the mouths of Sirion, not much can be learned from this. It is too condensed. But even allowing for speed and compression, there seem to be essential differences from B and C. Thus, in this outline, E, Elwing, as it appears, comes to Sirion at a later point in the story, after the departure of Tuor. But the raid and capture of Elwing seems to take place at an earlier point, while Eärendil is on his way back to Sirion from his shipwreck in the north, not, as in B and C, while he is on the great voyage in Wingolot that took him to Kor. Here it seems there was to be only one northward journey, ending in the shipwreck of Eärame/Eärum near Thalaskvil. Though it cannot be demonstrated, I incline to think that E was subsequent to B and C, partly because the reduction of two northward voyages ending in shipwreck to one seems more likely than the other way about, and partly because of the form Tuur, which, though it did not survive, replaced Tuor for a time, page 148. One or two other points may be noticed in this outline. The great spider called Ungwelionte in C, but here Wirilome, Gloomweaver, C1-152, is here encountered by Eärendil in the far south, not as in C on his westward voyage, see page 256. Elwing in this version comes to Eärendil as a seabird, as she does in the Silmarillion, page 247, which is not said in C, and even seems to be denied. Another isolated page, associated with the poem The Bidding of the Minstrel, see pages 269-70 below, gives a very curious account of Eärendil's great voyage. Eärendil's boat goes through north, Iceland, added in margin, back of north wind, Greenland and the wild islands. A mighty wind and crest of great wave carry him to hotter climes, to back of west wind. Land of strange men, land of magic, the home of night, the spider. He escapes from the meshes of knights with a few comrades, sees a great mountain island and a golden city, added in margin, core. Wind blows him southward. Tree men, sun dwellers, spices, fire mountains, Red Sea, Mediterranean, loses his boat, travels afoot through wilds of Europe, or Atlantic, footnote. The words in this passage, tree men, sun dwellers, are clear, but the punctuation is not, and the arrangement here may not be that intended. End of footnote. Home, waxes aged, has a new boat builded, bids adieu to his northland, sails west again to the lip of the world, just as the sun is diving into the sea. He sets sail upon the sky and returns no more to earth. The golden city was Kor, and he had caught the music of the Solosimpe, and returns to find it, only to find that the fairies have departed from Eldamar, see little book, dusted with diamond dust, climbing the deserted streets of Kor. One would certainly suppose this account to be earlier than anything so far considered, both from the fact that Eärendil's history after his return from the great voyage seems to bear no relation to that in B and C, and from his voyage being set in the lands and oceans of the known world. Were it not for the reference to the little book, which must mean Notebook C, from which the outline C above is taken, see page 254. But I think it very probable, and the appearance of the manuscript rather supports this, that the last paragraph, The Golden City Was Kor, was added later, and that the rest of the outline belongs with the earliest writing of the poem in the winter of 1914. It is notable that only here in the earliest writings is it made clear that the diamond dust that coated Eärendil came from the streets of Kor. Compare the passage from the Silmarillion cited on page 257. Another of the early Eärendil poems, The Shores of Faerie, as a short prose preface, which, if not as old as the first composition of the poem itself, July 1915, see page 271, is certainly not much later. Earendel, the wanderer who beat about the oceans of the world in his white ship Wingolot, sat long while in his old age upon the Isle of Seabirds in the northern waters ere he set forth upon a last voyage. He passed Tonequetl and even Valinor, and drew his bark over the bar at the margin of the world, and launched it on the oceans of the firmament. Of his ventures there no man has told, save that hunted by the orbed moon he fled back to Valinor, and mounting the towers of Kor upon the rocks of Eglamar, he gazed back upon the oceans of the world. To Eglamar he comes ever at plenilune, when the moon sails a-harrying beyond Tonequetl and Valinor. Footnote. This preface is found in all the texts of the poem save the earliest, and the versions of it differ only in name forms, Wingolot, Bingolot, and Eglamar, Eldamar, varying in the same ways as in the accompanying versions of the poem, see textual notes, page 272. And Kor replaced by Tún in the third text, Tún in the fourth. For Egla equals Elda, see 1251 and 2338, and for Tún, see page 292. End of footnote. Both here and in the outline associated with the bidding of the minstrel, Earendel was conceived to be an old man when he journeyed into the firmament. No other connected account of the tale of Earendel exists from the earliest period. There are, however, a number of separate notes, mostly in the form of single sentences, some found in the little notebook C, others jotted down on slips. I collect these references here more or less in the sequence of the tale. 1. Dwelling in the Isle of Sirion in a house of snow-white stone. In C, page 254, it is said that Earendel dwelt with Tuor and Idril at Sirion's mouth by the sea, on the Isles of Sirion. 2. The Oarni give to Earendel a wonderful shining silver coat that wets not. They love Earendel in Oth's despite, and teach him the lore of boat-building and of swimming, as he plays with them about the shores of Sirion. In the outlines are found references to the love of the Oarni for Earendel, D, page 259, the coming of the mermaids to him, E, page 260, and to Oth's enmity, C, page 254. 3. Earendel was smaller than most men, but nimble-footed and a swift swimmer. But Voronwë could not swim. 4. Idril and Earendel see Tuor's boat dropping into the twilight and a sound of song. In B, Tuor's sailing is secret, page 253. In C, Idril sees him too late, page 254. And in E, Earendel is present at Tuor's departure and thrusts the boat out. He hears a great song swelling from the sea, page 260. 5. Death of Idril, follows secretly after Tuor. That Idril died is denied in sea. Tuor and Idril, some say, sail now in Swanwing. Page 255. In D, Idril swam after him. Page 260. 6. Tuor has sailed back to Felosquil, and so back up Ilbrontoloth to Ascon, where he sits playing on his lonely harp on the islanded rock. This is marked with a query and an X, implying rejection of the idea. There are curious references to the islanded rock in Ascon in the outlines for Gilfalan's tale, see 1238. 7. The Fjord of the Mermaid, enchantment of his sailors. Mermaids are not Oarni, but are earthlings or fays, or both. In D, page 259, mermaids and Oarni are equated. 8. The ship Wingolot was built of wood from Felosquil with aid of the Oarni. This was probably said also in D, see page 260. 9. Wingolot was shaped as a swan of pearls. 10. The doves and pigeons of Turgon's courtyard bring message to Valinor, only to elves. Other references to the birds that flew from Gondolin also say that they came to the elves, or to Kor, pages 253, 255, 257. 11. During his voyages, Eärendil sights the white walls of Kor gleaming afar off, but is carried away by Ossa's adverse winds and waves. The same is said in B, page 253, of Eärendil's sighting of Tall Eressëa on his homeward voyage from Kor. 12. The sleeper in the Tower of Pearl awakened by Little Heart's going, a messenger that was dispatched years ago by Turgon and enmeshed in magics. Even now he cannot leave the tower and warns them of the magic. In C, there is a statement, rejected, that the sleeper in the Tower of Pearl was Idril herself. See note 6. 13. Ulmo's protection removed from Sirion in wrath at Eärendil's second attempt to Mondos, and hence Melko overwhelmed it. This note is struck through with an X written against it. But in D, page 260, it is said that Ulmo forbade his quest, but Eärendil would yet sail to find a passage to Mondos. The meaning of this must be that it was contrary to Ulmo's purpose that Eärendil should seek to Mondos for his father, but must rather attempt to reach Kor. 14. Eärendil weds Elwing before he sets sail. When he hears of her loss, he says that his children shall be all such men hereafter as dare the great seas in ships. With this compare The Cottage of Lost Play, 1.13, Even such a son of Eärendil as was this wayfarer, and 1.18, A man of great and excellent travel, a son meseems of Eärendil. In an outline of Ariel's life, 1.24, it is said that he was a son of Eärendil, born under his beam, and that if a beam from Eärendil fall on a child newborn, he becomes a child of Eärendil and a wanderer. In the early dictionary of Kenya, there is an entry, Eärendilion, son of Eärendil, used of any mariner, 1251. 15. Eärendil goes even to the empty halls of iron, seeking Elwing. Eärendil must have gone to Angamandi, empty after the defeat of Melko, at the same time as he went to the ruins of Gondolin, pages 253-255. 16. The loss of the ship carrying Elwing and the Nauglofring took place on the voyage to Tol Eressëa with the exodus of the elves from the great lands. See my remarks, pages 258-9. For the appeasing of Mim's curse by the drowning of the Nauglofring, see the appendix on names, entry Nauglofring. The departure of the elves to Tol Eressëa is discussed in the next chapter, page 280. 17. Eärendil and the Northern Tower on the Isle of Seabirds. In C, page 255, Eärendil sets sail with Varonwë and dwells on the Isle of Seabirds in the northern waters not far from Pelasquil, and there hopes that Elwing will return among the seabirds. In B, page 253, he cites the Isle of Seabirds, whither do all the birds of all waters come at whiles. There is a memory of this in the Silmarillion, page 250. Therefore there was built for Elwing a white tower northward upon the borders of the Sundering Sea, and thither at times all the seabirds of the earth repaired. 18. When Eärendil comes to Mondos, he finds that Tuor is not in Valinor, nor Eru-Mani, and neither elves nor Ainu know where he is. He is with Ulmo. In C, page 255, Eärendil, reaching the halls of Mondos, learns that Tuor is gone to Valinor. For the possibility that Tuor might be in Eru-Mani or Valinor, see 191 and following. 19. Eärendil returns from the firmament ever and anon with Varonwë to Kor, to see if the magic sun has been lit and the fairies have come back, but the moon drives him back. On Eärendil's return from the firmament, see 21 below. On the rekindling of the magic sun, see page 286. Two statements about Eärendil cited previously may be added here. 20. In the tale of the theft of Melko, 1.141, it is said that on the walls of Kor were many dark tales written in pictured symbols, and runes of great beauty were drawn there too, or carved upon stones, and Eärendil read many a wondrous tale there long ago. 21. The name list to the fall of Gondolin has the following entry, cited on page 215. Eärendil was the son of Tuor and Idril, and is said the only being that is half of the kindred of the Eldalie and half of men. He was the greatest and first of all mariners among men, and saw regions that men have not yet found nor gazed upon for all the multitude of their boats. He rideth now with Veronwe upon the winds of the firmament, nor comes ever further back than Kor, else would he die like other men, so much of the mortal is in him. In the outline associated with the poem, The Bidding of the Minstrel, Earendel sets sail upon the sky and returns no more to earth, page 261. In the prose preface to The Shores of Faery, to Eglamar he comes ever at Plenilun when the moon sails a-harrying beyond Tanaquetil and Valinor, page 262. In outline C, he cannot now return to the world or he will die, page 255. And in citation 19 above, he returns from the firmament ever and anon with Veronwe to Kor. In the Silmarillion, page 249, Manwë's judgment was that Earendel and Elwing shall not walk ever again among elves or men in the outer lands. But it is also said that Earendel returned to Valinor from his voyages beyond the confines of the world, Ibid, page 250, just as it is said in the name list to the fall of Gondolin that he does not come ever further back than Kor. The further statement in the name list, that if he did, he would die like other men, so much of the mortal is in him, was in some sense echoed long after in a letter of my father's written in 1967. Earendel, being in part descended from men, was not allowed to set foot on earth again, and became a star shining with the light of the Silmaril. The Letters of J.R.R. Tolkien, number 297. This brings to an end all the prose materials that bear on the earliest form of the tale of Earendel, apart from a few other references to him that appear in the next chapter. With these outlines and notes, we are at a very early stage of composition, when the conceptions were fluid and had not been given even preliminary narrative form. The myth was present in certain images that were to endure, but these images had not been articulated. I have already noticed, page 257, the remarkable fact that there is no hint of the idea that it was Earendel who by his intercession brought aid out of the west. Equally, there is no suggestion that the Valar hallowed his ship and set him in the sky, nor that his light was that of the Silmaril. Nonetheless, there were already present the coming of Earendel to Kor, Tirion, and finding it deserted, the dust of diamonds on his shoes, the changing of Elwing into a seabird, the passing of his ship through the door of night, and the sanction against his return to the lands east of the sea. The raid on the havens of Sirion appears in the early outlines, though that was an act of Melkor's, not of the Feanorians. And Tuor's departure also, but without Idril, whom he left behind. His ship was Alcarame, Swanwing. Afterwards it bore the name Earame, with the meaning Seawing, the Silmarillion, page 245, which retained, in form but not in meaning, the name of Earendel's first ship, Earame Eagle Pinion, pages 253-4 and see note 9. It is interesting to read my father's statement made some half-century later in the letter of 1967 referred to above concerning the origins of Earendel. The name is in fact, as is obvious, derived from Anglo-Saxon Earendel. When first studying Anglo-Saxon professionally, 1913 on, I had done so as a boyish hobby when supposed to be learning Greek and Latin. I was struck by the great beauty of this word, or name, entirely coherent with the normal style of Anglo-Saxon, but euphonic to a peculiar degree in that pleasing but not delectable language. Although its form strongly suggests that it is in origin a proper name and not a common noun. This is borne out by the obviously related forms in other Germanic languages, from which, amid the confusions and debasements of late traditions, it at least seems certain that it belonged to astronomical myth, and was the name of a star or star group. To my mind, the Anglo-Saxon uses seem plainly to indicate that it was a star presaging the dawn, at any rate in English tradition. That is what we now call Venus. The morning star, as it may be seen, shining brilliantly in the dawn before the actual rising of the sun. That is, at any rate, how I took it. Before 1914, I wrote a poem upon Earendel who launched his ship like a bright spark from the havens of the sun. I adopted him into my mythology, in which he became a prime figure as a mariner, and eventually as a herald star and a sign of hope to men. Aya Earendel Alenion Alcalima, the Lord of the Rings, 2329. Hail Earendel, brightest of stars, is derived at long remove from Eala Earendel Engla Beortast. Footnote, from the Old English poem, Christ. Eala Earendel Engla Beortast offer middangiard monum sended. End of footnote. But the name could not be adopted just like that. It had to be accommodated to the elvish linguistic situation at the same time as a place for this person was made in legend. From this far back in the history of elvish, which was beginning after many tentative starts in boyhood to take definite shape at the time of the name's adoption, arose eventually A, the common elvish stem, IR, C, primarily applied to the great sea of the west, lying between Middle Earth and Aman, the blessed realm of the Valar. And B, the element or verbal base NDIL, to love, be devoted to, describing the attitude of one to a person, thing, cause, or occupation to which one is devoted for its own sake. Earendel became a character in the earliest written, 1916-17, of the major legends. The Fall of Gondolin, the greatest of the Pereldar, half-elven, son of Tuor of the most renowned house of the Edain, and Idril, daughter of the king of Gondolin. My father did not indeed hear say that his Earendel contained from the beginning elements that in combination give a meaning like sea-lover, but it is in any case clear that at the time of the earliest extant writings on the subject, the name was associated with an elvish word, Ea, eagle. See page 265 on the name of Earendel's first ship, Earame, eagle pinion. In the name list to the Fall of Gondolin, this is made explicit. Earendel, spelled here E-A-R-E-N-D-L. Though belike it hath some kinship to the elfin Ea and Earen, eagle, and Eiri, wherefore cometh to mind the passage of Christhorn and the use of the sign of the eagle by Idril, see page 193, is thought to be woven of that secret tongue of the Gondothlim, see page 165. I give lastly four early poems of my father's in which Earendel appears. 1. Eala Earendel Engla Beortas. There can be little doubt that, as Humphrey Carpenter supposes, biography, page 71, this was the first poem on the subject of Earendel that my father composed, and that it was written at Phoenix Farm, Gedling, Nottinghamshire, in September 1914. Note 10. The two earliest extant texts dated thus, one of them with the edition, Exeter College Essay Club, December 1914, and on a third is written Gedling, Nottinghamshire, September 1913, error for 1914, and later. My father referred to having read Earendel to the Essay Club in a letter to my mother of 27 November 1914. End of note. It was to this poem that he was referring in the letter of 1967 just cited. I wrote a poem upon Earendel who launched his ship like a bright spark. Compare line 5, he launched his bark like a silver spark. There are some 5 different versions, each one incorporating emendations made in the predecessor, though only the first verse was substantially rewritten. The title was originally The Voyage of Earendel, the Evening Star, together with, as customarily, an Old English version of this, Shipferald Earendeles Efens Theoren. This was changed in a later copy to Eala Earendel Engla Beortast, The Last Voyage of Earendel, and in still later copies the modern English name was removed. I give it here in the last version, the date of which cannot be determined, though the handwriting shows it to be substantially later than the original composition. Together with all the divergent readings of the earliest extant version in footnotes. Earendel arose where the shadow flows at ocean's silent brim. Through the mouth of night as a ray of light where the shores are sheer and dim, he launched his bark like a silver spark from the last and lonely sand. And on sunlit breath of day's fiery death he sailed from Westerland. He threaded his path o'er the aftermath of the splendor of the sun, and wandered far past many a star in his gleaming galleon. On the gathering tide of darkness ride the argosies of the sky, and spangle the night with their sails of light as the streaming star goes by. Unheeding, he dips past these twinkling ships, by his wayward spirit whirled on an endless quest through the darkling west or the margin of the world. And he fares in haste o'er the jeweled waste and the dusk from whence he came, with his heart afire with bright desire and his face in silver flame. End of side 9. To continue, turn the cassette over. Side 10, The Book of Lost Tales, Part 2, by J.R.R. Tolkien. Continuing on page 268. The ship of the moon from the east comes soon from the haven of the sun, whose white gates gleam in the coming beam of the mighty silver one. Though with bellying clouds as his vessel shrouds, he weighs anchor down the dark, and on shimmering oars leaves the blazing shores in his argent-timbered bark. Then Earendel fled from that shipman dread beyond the dark earth's pale, back under the rim of the ocean dim, and behind the world's set sail. And he heard the mirth of the folk of earth and the falling of their tears, as the world dropped back in a cloudy rack on its journey down the years. Then he glimmering passed to the starless vast as an eyelid lamp at sea, and beyond the ken of mortal men set his lonely errantry, tracking the sun in his galleon through the pathless firmament, till his light grew old in abysses cold and his eager flame was spent. Readings of the earliest version, lines 1-8. Earendel sprang up from the ocean's cup in the gloom of the mid-world's rim, from the door of night as a ray of light leapt over the twilight brim, and launching his bark like a silver spark from the golden fading sand, down the sunlit breath of day's fiery death, he sped from Westerland. Line 10, Splendor, formerly Glory. Line 11, Wandered, formerly Went Wandering. Line 16, Streaming, formerly Evening. Line 17, Unheeding, formerly But Unheeding. Line 18, Wayward, formerly Wandering. Line 19, Endless, formerly Magic Darkling, formerly Darkening. Line 20, O'er the Margin, formerly Toward the Margent. Line 22, And the Dusk, formerly To the Dusk. Line 25, The Ship, formerly For the Ship. Line 31, Blazing, formerly Skyey. Line 32, Timbered, formerly Orbed. Line 33, Then, formerly And. Line 38, And the Falling of, formerly And Hearkened to. Lines 46 to 48, And voyaging the skies till his splendor was shorn by the birth of morn, and he died with the dawn in his eyes. There seems every reason to think that this poem preceded all the outlines and notes given in this chapter, and that verbal similarities to the poem found in these are echoes. For example, his face is in silver flame, outline C, page 255, the margent of the world, outline E, page 260. In the fourth verse of the poem, the ship of the moon comes forth from the haven of the sun. In the tale of the hiding of Valinor, 1-215, Aule and Ulmo built two havens in the east, that of the sun, which was wide and golden, and that of the moon, which was white, having gates of silver and of pearl. But they were both within the same harborage. As in the poem, in the tale of the sun and moon, the moon is urged on by shimmering oars. 1-195. 2. The Bidding of the Minstrel. This poem, according to a note that my father scribbled on one of the copies, was written at St. John's Street, Oxford, C. 127, in the winter of 1914. There is no other evidence for its date. In this case, the earliest workings are extant, and on the back of one of the sheets is the outline account of Earendel's great voyage given on page 261. The poem was then much longer than it became, but the workings are exceedingly rough. They have no title. To the earliest finished text, a title was added hastily later. This apparently reads, The Minstrel Renounces the Song. The title then became The Lay of Earendel, changed in the latest text to the bidding of the minstrel from the lay of Earendel. There are four versions following the original rough draft, but the changes made in them were slight, and I give the poem here in the latest form, noting only that originally the minstrel seems to have responded to the bidding much earlier, at line 5, which read, "Then hearken, a tale of immortal sea-yearning," and that Eldar in line 6 and Elven in line 23 are emendations made on the latest text of Faerie's Faerie. "Sing us yet more of Earendel the Wandering, chant us a lay of his white-oared ship, more marvellous cunning than mortal man's pondering, foamily musical out on the deep. Sing us a tale of immortal sea-yearning, the Eldar once made ere the change of the light, weaving a wine-like spell and a burning wonder of spray and the odours of night, of murmurous gloamings out on far oceans, of his tossing at anchor off islets forlorn to the unsleeping waves' never-ending sea-motions, of bellying sails when a wind was born, and the gurgling bubble of tropical water tinkled from under the ringed stem, and thousands of miles was his ship from those wrought her, a petrel, a sea-bird, a white-winged gem, gallantly bent on measureless faring ere she came homing in sea-laden flight, circuitous, lingering, restlessly daring, coming to haven unlooked for at night." But the music is broken, the words half forgotten, the sunlight has faded, the moon has grown old. The elven ships foundered, or weeds swathed and rotten, the fire and the wonder of hearts is a cold. Who now can tell, and what heart can accompany, with melodies strange enough, rich enough tunes, pale with the magic of cavernous harmony, loud with shore music of beaches and dunes? How slender his boat, of what glimmering timber, how her sails were all silvern, and taper her mast, and silver her throat with foam, and her limber flanks as she swan-like floated past. The song I can sing is but shreds one remembers of golden imaginings fashioned in sleep, a whispered tale told by the withering embers of old things far off that but few hearts keep. 3. The Shores of Faerie. This poem is given in its earliest form by Humphrey Carpenter, biography, pages 76 to 7. Note 11, but rocks in line 27, 26, should read rock. End of note. It exists in four versions each, as usual, incorporating slight changes. My father wrote the date of its composition on three of the copies, namely July 8 to 9, 1915, Mosley and Edgbaston, Birmingham, July 1915, walking and on bus. Retouched often since, especially 1924. And first poem of my mythology, Valinor, illegible, 1910. This last cannot have been intended for the date of composition, and the illegible words preceding it may possibly be read as thought of about, but it does not in any case appear to have been the first poem of the mythology. That, I believe, was Eala Earendel Engla Beortast, and my father's mention of this poem in his letter of 1967, see page 266, seems to suggest this also. The Old English title was Ylfalandes Strand, The Shores of Elfland. It is preceded by a short prose preface, which has been given above, page 262. I give it here in the latest version, undateable, with all readings from the earliest in footnotes. East of the moon, west of the sun, there stands a lonely hill. Its feet are in the pale green sea, its towers are white and still, beyond Taniquetil in Valinor. Comes never there but one lone star that fled before the moon, and there the two trees naked are that bore night's silver bloom, that bore the globed fruit of noon in Valinor. There are the shores of Faerie with their moonlit pebbled strand, whose foam is silver music on the opalescent floor, beyond the great sea shadows, on the marches of the sand, that stretches on forever to the dragon-headed door, the gateway of the moon, beyond Taniquetil in Valinor. West of the sun, east of the moon, lies the haven of the star, the white town of the wanderer and the rocks of Eglamar. There Wingolot is harbored, while Earendel looks afar, or the darkness of the waters between here and Eglamar, out, out beyond Taniquetil in Valinor afar. Readings of the earliest version. Line 1, east of the moon, west of the sun, formerly west of the moon, east of the sun. Line 7, no stars come there but one alone. Line 8, fled before, formerly hunted with. Line 9, for there the two trees naked grow. Line 10, boar, formerly bear. Line 11, boar, formerly bear. Line 18, marches, formerly margent. Lines 20 to 21, to the dragon-headed door, the gateway of the moon, formerly from the golden feet of Kor. Line 24, west of the sun, east of the moon, formerly, O, west of the moon, east of the sun. Line 27, rocks, formerly rock. Line 28, Wingalot, formerly earliest text Wingalot, replaced by Vingalot. Second text, Vingalot. Third text, Vingalot, replaced by Wingalot. Last text, Wingalot. Line 30, or the darkness of the waters, formerly on the magic and the wonder. Line 31, between, formerly tween. In the latest text, Elvenland is lightly written over Faerie in line 13, and Eldamar against Eglamar in line 27, only. Eglamar replaced by Eldamar in the second text. There are some interesting connections between this poem and the tale of the coming of the elves and the making of Kor. The lonely hill of line 2 is the hill of Kor. Compare the tale 1-122. At the head of this long creek there stands a lonely hill which gazes at the loftier mountains, while the golden feet of Kor, a line replaced in the later versions of the poem, and very probably the sand that stretches on forever, are explained by the passage that follows in the tale. Thither, that is to Kor, did Aule bring all the dust of magic metals that his great works had made and gathered, and he piled it about the foot of that hill, and most of this dust was of gold, and the sand of gold stretched away from the feet of Kor out into the distance where the two trees blossomed. With the dragon-headed door, line 20, compare the description of the door of night in the hiding of Valinor, 1:215-16. Its pillars are of the mightiest basalt, and its lintel likewise, but great dragons of black stone are carved thereon, and shadowy smoke pours slowly from their jaws. In that description, the door of night is not, however, the gateway of the moon, for it is the sun that passes through it into the outer dark, whereas the moon dares not the utter loneliness of the outer dark by reason of his lesser light and majesty, and he journeys still beneath the world, that is, through the waters of Vi. 4. The Happy Mariners. I give lastly this poem whose subject is the Tower of Pearl in the Twilight Isles. It was written in July 1915. Note 12, according to one note, it was written at Barnt Green, see Biography, page 36, July 1915, and Bedford, and later. And another note dates it July 24, 1915, rewritten September 9. The original workings are on the back of an unsent letter dated from Moseley, Birmingham, July 11, 1915. My father began military training at Bedford on July 19, end of note. And there are six texts preceding the version which was published together with Why the Man in the Moon Came Down Too Soon at Leeds in 1923, and which is the first of the two given here. Footnote. 1923, A Northern Venture, see 1204, footnote. Mr. Douglas A. Anderson has kindly supplied me with a copy of the poem in this version, which had been very slightly altered from that published in the Stapledon Magazine, Exeter College, Oxford, June 1920, Carpenter, page 268. Twilight in line 5 of the Leeds version is almost certainly an error for Twilight, the reading of all the original texts. End of footnote. 1. I know a window in a western tower that opens on celestial seas, and wind that has been blowing round the stars comes to nestle in its tossing draperies. It is a white tower builded in the twilight aisles, where evening sits forever in the shade. It glimmers like a spike of lonely pearl that mirrors beams forlorn and lights that fade. And sea goes washing round the dark rock where it stands, and fairy boats go by to gloaming lands, all piled and twinkling in the gloom, with hoarded sparks of orient fire that divers one in waters of the unknown sun. And maybe 'tis a throbbing silver lyre, or voices of grey sailors echo up afloat among the shadows of the world in oarless shallop and with canvas furled, for often seems there ring of feet and song, or twilight twinkle of a trembling gong. O happy mariners upon a journey long to those great portals on the western shores, where far away constellate fountains leap, and dashed against night's dragon-headed doors, in foam of stars fall sparkling in the deep. While I alone look out behind the moon from in my white and windy tower, ye bide no moment and await no hour, but chanting snatches of a mystic tune go through the shadows and the dangerous seas, past sunless lands to fairy leas, where stars upon the jacinth wall of space do tangle, burst, and interlace. Ye follow Earendel through the west, the shining mariner to islands blessed, while only from beyond that somber rim a wind returns to stir these crystal panes, and murmur magically of golden rains that fall forever in those spaces dim. In The Hiding of Valinor, 1-215, it is told that when the sun was first made, the Valar purposed to draw it beneath the earth, but that it was too frail and lissome, and much precious radiance was spilled in their attempts about the deepest waters, and escaped to linger as secret sparks in many an unknown ocean cavern. These have many elfin divers and divers of the fays, long time sought beyond the outmost east, even as is sung in the song of the sleeper in the Tower of Pearl. That the happy mariners was in fact the song of the sleeper in the Tower of Pearl seems assured by lines 10-13 of the poem. For night's dragon-headed doors, see page 273. The meaning of jacinth in the jacinth wall of space, line 31, is blue. Compare the deep blue walls in The Hiding of Valinor, 1-215. Many years later, my father rewrote the poem, and I give this version here. Still later, he turned to it again and made a few further alterations, here recorded in footnotes. At this time, he noted that the revised version dated from 1940, ? 2. I know a window in a western tower that opens on celestial seas. And there from wells of dark behind the stars blows ever cold a keen unearthly breeze. It is a white tower builded on the twilight isles, and springing from their everlasting shade, it glimmers like a house of lonely pearl where lights forlorn take harbor ere they fade. Its feet are washed by waves that never rest. Fair silent boats go by into the west, all piled and twinkling in the dark, with orient fire in many a hoarded spark that divers one in waters of the rumored sun. There sometimes throbs below a silver harp, touching the heart with sudden music sharp, or far beneath the mountains high and sheer the voices of grey sailors echo clear, afloat among the shadows of the world in oarless ships and with their canvas furled, chanting a farewell and a solemn song, for wide the sea is, and the journey long. O happy mariners upon a journey far, beyond the grey islands and past Gondabar, to those great portals on the final shores, where far away constellate fountains leap, and dashed against night's dragon-headed doors, in foam of stars fall sparkling in the deep. While I alone look out behind the moon from in my white and windy tower, ye bide no moment and await no hour, but go with solemn song and harper's tune through the dark shadows and the shadowy seas to the last land of the two trees, whose fruit and flower are moon and sun, where light of earth is ended and begun. Ye follow Earendel without rest, the shining mariner beyond the west, who passed the mouth of night and launched his bark upon the outer seas of everlasting dark. Here only comes at whiles a wind to blow, returning darkly down the way ye go, with perfume laden of unearthly trees. Here only long afar through window pane I glimpse the flicker of a golden rain that falls forever on the outer seas. Last revisions. Line 3, and there, omitted. Line 4, blows ever cold, changed to there ever blows. Line 17, mountains, changed to mountain. Line 22, the journey, changed to their journey. Line 29, while I look out alone. Line 30, imprisoned in the white and windy tower. Line 31, ye, changed to you. Lines 33 to 36, struck through. Line 37, ye, changed to you. Line 40, outer, omitted. Lines 41 to 43, struck through. Line 46, the, changed to those. Line added at end, beyond the country of the shining trees. I cannot explain the reference in the revised version only, line 24, to the journey of the mariners beyond the grey islands and past Gondobar. Gondobar, city of stone, was one of the seven names of Gondolin, page 158. 6. The History of Ariel, or Alfwina and the End of the Tales. In this final chapter, we come to the most difficult, though not, as I hope to show, altogether insoluble, part of the earliest form of the mythology. Its end, with which is intertwined the story of Ariel, Alfwina, and with that, the history and original significance of Tol Eressëa. For its elucidation, we have some short pieces of connected narrative, but are largely dependent on the same materials as those that constitute Gilfanan's tale and the story of Earendil. Scribbled plot outlines, endlessly varying, written on separate slips of paper or in the pages of the little notebook C, see page 254. In this chapter, there is much material to consider, and for convenience of reference within the chapter, I number the various citations consecutively. But it must be said that no device of presentation can much diminish the inherent complexity and obscurity of the matter. The fullest account, bald as it is, of the March of the Elves of Kor and the events that followed is contained in Notebook C, continuing on from the point where I left that outline on page 255 after the coming of the birds from Gondolin, the councils of the gods and uproar of the elves, and the march of the Inwyr and Teleri, with the Solosimpi only agreeing to accompany the expedition on condition that they remain by the sea. The outline continues, 1. Coming of the Eldar, encampment in the land of willows of first host, overwhelming of Noldorin and Volwer, wanderings of Noldorin with his harp. Tulkas overthrows Melko in the Battle of the Silent Pools, bound in Lumbi and guarded by Gorgumoth, the Hound of Mondos. Release of the Noldorli. War with men as soon as Tulkas and Noldorin have fared back to Valinor. Noldorli led to Valinor by Egulmoth and Goldor. There have been previous references in the Lost Tales to a battle in Tassarinan, the Land of Willows. In the Tale of Turambar, pages 70-140, and most notably in The Fall of Gondolin, page 154, where when Tuor's sojourn in that land is described, there is mention of events that would take place there in the future. Did not even after the days of Tuor, Noldorin, and his Eldar come there seeking for Dor Lormin and the hidden river and the caverns of the gnome's imprisonment, yet thus nigh to their quest's end were like to abandon it? Indeed, sleeping and dancing here, they were whelmed by the goblins, sped by Melko from the hills of iron, and Noldorin made bare escape thence. Valwer has been mentioned once before by Lindo on Ariel's first evening in Marvanwa Tialieva, 1.16. My father Valwer, who went with Noldorin to find the gnomes. Of Noldorin we know also that he was the Vala Salmar, the twin brother of Omar Amilo, that he entered the world with Ulmo, and that in Valinor he played the harp and lyre and loved the northerly. 166-75-93-126. An isolated note states, 2. Noldorin escapes from the defeat of the Land of Willows and takes his harp and goes seeking in the Iron Mountains for Valwer and the gnomes until he finds their place of imprisonment. Tulkas follows. Melko comes to meet him. The only one of the great Valar who is mentioned in these notes as taking part in the expedition to the great lands is Tulkas. But whatever story underlay his presence, despite the anger and sorrow of the Valar at the March of the Elves, see page 257, is quite irrecoverable. A very faint hint concerning it is found in two isolated notes. Tulkas gives, or the elves take, Limpe with them, and Limpe given by the gods, Orome, Tulkas. When elves left Valinor, compare the flight of the Norderly, 1-166. No Limpe had they, the Norderly, as yet to bring away, for that was not given to the fairies until long after, and the march of liberation was undertaken. According to one above, Tulkas fought with and overthrew Melko in the Battle of the Silent Pools, and the Silent Pools are the Pools of Twilight, where Tulkas after fought with Melko's self. The Fall of Gondolin, page 195. The original reading here was Noldorin and Tulkas. The name Lumbi is found elsewhere, in a list of names associated with the tale of the coming of the Valar, 193, where it is said to be Melko's third dwelling. And a jotting in Notebook C, sufficiently mysterious, reads, Lumfod, Melko's dwelling after release, Castle of Lumbi. But this story also is lost. That the Noldorin were led back to Valinor by Egalmoth and Galdor, as stated in 1, is notable. This is contradicted in detail by a statement in the name list to the Fall of Gondolin, which says, page 215, that Egalmoth was slain in the raid on the dwelling at the mouth of Sirion when Elwing was taken, and contradicted in general by the next citation to be given, which denies that the elves were permitted to dwell in Valinor. The only other statement concerning these events is found in the first of the four outlines that constitute Gilfonan's tale, which I there called A, 1-234. This reads, 3. March of the Elves out into the world. The capture of Noldorin. The camp in the Land of Willows. Army of Tulkas at the Pools of Twilight. And, question mark many in brackets, gnomes. But men fall on them out of Hisalome. Defeat of Melko. Breaking of Angamandi and release of captives. Hostility of men. The gnomes collect some of the jewels. Elwing and most of the elves go back to dwell in Tol Aresia. The gods will not let them dwell in Valinor. This seems to differ from 1 in the capture of Noldorin and in the attack of men from Hisalome before the defeat of Melko. But the most notable statement is that concerning the refusal of the gods to allow the elves to dwell in Valinor. There is no reason to think that this ban rested only or chiefly on the Noldorin. The text 3 does not refer specifically to the gnomes in this connection. And the ban is surely to be related to the sorrow and wrath of the gods at the time of the March of the Elves, page 253. Further, it is said in The Cottage of Lost Play, 116, that Ingil, son of Inwe, returned to Tol Aresia with most of the fairest and the wisest, most of the merriest and the kindest of all the Eldar, and that the town that he built there was named Koromas, or the Resting of the Exiles of Kor. This is quite clearly to be connected with the statement in 3 that most of the elves go back to dwell in Tol Aresia, and with that given on page 255, the wars with men and the departure to Tol Aresia, the Eldar unable to endure the strife of the world. These indications taken together leave no doubt, I think, that my father's original conception was of the Eldar of Valinor undertaking the expedition into the great lands against the will of the Valar. Together with the rescued Noldorin, they returned over the ocean, but being refused re-entry into Valinor, they settled in Tol Aresia as the Exiles of Kor. That some did return in the end to Valinor may be concluded from the words of Meryl y Torinki, 1-129, that Ingil, who built Cortirion, went long ago back to Valinor and is with Manwë. But Tol Aresia remained the land of the fairies in the early conception, the exiles of Kor, Eldar, and gnomes, speaking both Ildarissa and Noldarissa. It seems that there is nothing else to be found or said concerning the original story of the coming of Aed out of the west and the renewed assault on Melko. The conclusion of the whole story, as originally envisaged, was to be rejected in its entirety. For it, we are very largely dependent on the outline in Notebook C, continuing on from citation 1 above. This is extremely rough and disjointed, and is given here in a very slightly edited form. 4. After the departure of Eärendil and the coming of the elves to Tall Eressëa, and most of this belongs to the history of men, great ages elapse. Men spread and thrive, and the elves of the great lands fade. As men's stature grows, theirs diminishes. Men and elves were formerly of a size, though men always larger. Note 1. On this statement about the stature of elves and men, see pages 326 to 7. End of note. Melko again breaks away by the aid of Tevildo, who in long ages gnaws his bonds. The gods are in dissension about men and elves, some favoring the one and some the other. Melko goes to Tall Eressëa and tries to stir up dissension among the elves between gnomes and Solosimpi, who are in consternation and send to Valinor. No help comes, but Tulkas sends privily Telemektar, Taimonto, his son. Note 2. For the form Taimonto, Taimondo, see 1268, entry Telemektar. End of note. Telemektar of the Silver Sword and Ingils surprise Melko and wound him, and he flees and climbs up the great pine of Tavrobo. Before the Inwyr left Valinor, Belaurin, Palurian, gave them a seed, and said that it must be guarded, for great tidings would one day come of its growth. Note 3. Belaurin is the gnomish equivalent of Palurian, see 1264. End of note. But it was forgotten, and cast in the garden of Gilfonan, and a mighty pine arose that reached to Ilwë and the stars. Note 4. A side note here suggests that perhaps the pine should not be in Tall Eressëa, for Ilwë, the middle air, that is blue and clear and flows among the stars. See 1.65.73. End of note. Telemektar and Ingil pursue him, and they remain now in the sky to ward it, and Melko stalks high above the air, seeking ever to do a hurt to the sun and moon and stars, eclipses, meteors. He is continually frustrated, but on his first attempt, saying that the gods stole his fire for its making, he upset the sun, so that Urwendi fell into the sea, and the ship fell near the ground, scorching regions of the earth. The clarity of the sun's radiance has not been so great since, and something of magic has gone from it. Hence it is, and long has been, that the fairies dance and sing more sweetly, and can the better be seen by the light of the moon, because of the death of Urwendi. The rekindling of the magic sun refers in part to the trees, and in part to Urwendi. Fionwë's rage and grief. In the end, he will slay Melko. Orion is only the image of Telemektar in the sky? Sick. Varda gave him stars, and he bears them aloft that the gods may know he watches. He has diamonds on his sword sheath, and this will go red when he draws his sword at the great end. But now Telemektar and Gil, who follows him like a blue bee, ward off evil, and Varda immediately replaces any stars that Melko loosens and casts down. Note 5. Gil equals Ingil. At the first occurrence of Ingil in this passage, the name was written Ingil, Gil in brackets, but Gil was struck out. End of note. Although grieved at the gods' behest, the pine is cut down, and Melko is thus now out of the world. But one day he will find a way back, and the last great uproars will begin before the great end. The evils that still happen come about in this wise. The gods can cause things to enter the hearts of men, but not of elves, hence their difficult dealings in the old days of the exile of the gnomes. And though Melko sits without, gnawing his fingers and gazing in anger on the world,